I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania Commonwealth Court Judge Robert Simpson ruled on Tuesday that voters going to the polls in November won't have to show identification in order to cast their ballot. They may be asked for ID as they were in the primary earlier this year, but if they don't have it, they can still vote. When the voter ID law was passed, a number of organizations created campaigns to educate voters about the new law and what it would take to get the proper ID. Slate columnist Sasha Eisenberg looked at new research on these Get Out the Vote efforts, and the results may surprise you. He joins us on Radio Times. He's Victory Lab columnist for Slate, Washington correspondent for Monocle, covering politics, business, diplomacy, and culture, wrote a book called The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. And Sasha Eisenberg, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Would it be fair enough to say that what happened in Pennsylvania, these Get Out the Vote efforts, were pretty similar to what happened in other voter ID states across the country?
Well, I mean, the Pennsylvania Democratic Party and a lot of allies had been working sort of on two fronts until the decision this week. One was an education campaign to let people know what the law was and what type of documents were available. But then the state party was running what was a basically an effort to get people to the state centers where they could apply for the new IDs that was in many ways a sort of get-out-the-vote style operation. Identifying voters, picking them up at their homes, putting them in vans and driving them. They actually ended up doing a lot of the groundwork that they would be doing in the days before the election, sort of figuring out who their voters are and how they can engage them. But what's happened around the country is people have been toying with this question of, can just telling voters about voter ID laws and this sort of idea that these are Republican plots to disenfranchise you, targeted minority communities, can they be their own motivator of getting people to turn out and voting? And I wrote about this experiment in Wisconsin that suggested otherwise.
And I do want to get to that. But the idea being that if someone is told the government or a particular party or the Republican Party is trying to disenfranchise you, that people will get so angry that they'll go out and vote. That was kind of the thesis or a thesis. Did we lose our guest? I think we might have lost our guest. We will find an answer to that question once we call him back. And again, talking with Sasha Eisenberg, who has been looking at some interesting new research on these various get-out-the-vote efforts. And that certainly was happening here in Pennsylvania. Other states that had instituted or were in the process of instituting new voter ID laws. And there were a number of efforts to not just educate voters about what their rights were, what these new laws were, but also efforts and some would say perhaps even scare tactics to get people to vote. And what he has done is look at some interesting research that looked at a number of other states about these various get out the vote efforts and how to educate people about what their rights are and how all that works. And Sasha, do we have you back?
We do. Apologies.
That was okay. Very pregnant pause there. Nonetheless, what I was asking you was the part of the messaging was that to say to a voter, look, someone is trying to take away your right to vote, that in and of itself would get people inspired enough or perhaps even angry enough that they would want to vote. That was the kind of running thesis.
Right. And one of the big strategic challenges for Democrats this year widely has been how do you re-engage parts of the Democratic base, especially minorities, young voters who may have turned out to vote for Obama in 2008, what do you get them to see that they're high stakes and high enough stakes in this re-election that they should vote if they're infrequent voters? And, there's a widely held assumption among folks on the left. I quote one of Obama's pollsters, John Anzalone, who said, yeah, this is going to piss people off and it's going to be an incredible get-out-the-vote tool. The idea of just going to them, whether or not they would individually be threatened by a new ID law, but just saying that there's an effort to take away your right to vote and you should go exercise it.
And what you did is looked at some research, people that were actually experimenting with this idea. What was this experiment about?
Sure. And so in Wisconsin, before we remember the Walker gubernatorial recall election in June, there had initially been a law in the book similar to Pennsylvania's that would have required ID in that election. And similar to what's happened in Pennsylvania, a court delayed implementation of it. But before that, a group called the League of Young Voters organized this experiment. So it's basically a field experiment, a randomized control trial. So it's basically a drug trial. Except they've randomly assigned canvassing scripts. And so the volunteer canvassers who are knocking on doors in Milwaukee as part of this project read one of two scripts to voters at the door. One of them is a basic get-out-the-vote reminder, which says things like, there's an election coming up on Tuesday, we expect a lot of people to vote, make sure you come out and be part of it, it's an important election, here's where your polling place is. And then the other script has all of that information, but has overlaid onto it a message similar to the one you're talking about. There's an effort afoot by people to disenfranchise minority communities. They want to take away your right to vote. Don't let them do that. Show that this is an important right that you're going to take advantage of.
And so
they randomly assign these treatments. Then you can go back afterwards, and the voter rolls are public, so you can see who voted and who didn't, and you can attribute the difference to the different types of scripts.
And how different were the results?
It turns out that the script that mentions voter ID was quite influential in getting older voters, 55 and over, to vote. But for the rest of the population, it was actually less effective than a standard canvassing script. It had an improvement of something like 1 percentage point increase in turnout. The people who heard the voter ID thing, the population who heard the regular standard script was 2 percentage points. And so it totally went contrary to this idea that that this would sort of be a good universal motivator among, and this was mostly this was black voters in across Milwaukee. And it turned out that the standard message that talks about voting as this sort of social activity that a lot of people are doing is apparently a better lure to the polls than scaring people into thinking that there's an effort to deny them the vote.
I'm interested, though, in this 55 and older group. How dramatically different was their voter turnout?
It was another point on top of the, so I think it was a total of about 3 points over the control group, the group that got no contact at all. And the sort of working thesis, at least among the people who designed the experiment, was that these are folks who lived through the civil rights movement, that the sort of language about rights and was sort of far more salient to them, and that they had sort of been conditioned to see that as a lens through engaging in political behavior, but that voters who were younger than that, who weren't sort of shaped by the legacy of the civil rights movement, might not have responded to it in the same way.
But it doesn't seem, I have to say, as an outsider, it doesn't seem dramatically different.
Well, I mean, you can look at Florida in 2000 and think about what 1 point can do. I mean, there's all sorts of science that's going on, especially through these field experiments that are about small marginal improvements. Right. But I think that there are a lot of people who are looking at politics in swing states this year who would be very happy to know the difference between something that can motivate an extra 1% or 2% or 3% of their coalition to turn out.
Obviously, tailoring it to whoever answers the door. If it's, let's say, an older African-American woman, you might want to talk about voter suppression.
Right. And, you know, this was the first experiment, the first field experiment that actually was able to test this in the field and test the effect. It was a sort of odd election. It was a recall election. It sort of had its own dynamic. So I think everybody who's been involved in this is wary of universalizing too much. But what it was useful at doing, I think, was sort of putting a brake on some of the assumptions that had been developed among people on the left, that this would be a useful messaging tool regardless of sort of the state of the law. And these findings are sort of making their way through people on the left that run candidate campaigns and get out the vote efforts for non-profit groups, trying to, you know, figure out how much of this language, especially in Pennsylvania if the law is no longer on the books, they should be integrating into their normal campaign communications.
And speaking even more broadly, the idea of voting as a civic duty, or voting because your neighbor is voting, or voting because you belong to a larger community, is that a message that can have an impact?
Well, each of those is a little different, and psychologists have done a good job through these experiments of sort of unpacking the different mechanisms that are at work in each of them. The old idea that people have been running now these field experiments for almost 15 years, academics and people in campaigns, and almost everything we've seen is that the traditional sort of League of Women Voters style, exercise your civic responsibility, be a good citizen, has no impact whatsoever on motivating people to vote. What has worked are interventions are sort of informed by behavioral psychology, the most successful of which was showing voters a copy of their vote history, the elections in which they participated, the elections in which their neighbors participated, and threatened to out them if they didn't vote. We know that if you talk about voting as a popular activity, you emphasize the way turnout is expected to be high as opposed to sort of despairing about how many people don't vote, but just talking about it in different terms motivates people to vote. And so there's some idea that people want to fit in and take part in a popular activity, not be part of something that's sort of small. And there was a way in which I think the language around voter ID, which said they're trying to disenfranchise our community, was a way of sort of maybe relieving a sense of responsibility that voters had, well, that they needed to fit in with good behavior. And so there's a sense in which talking about civic duty is a lot different than telling people you should fit in with what your neighbors are doing.
And does this work for Democrats, Republicans, Independents, or do those voters, in a sense, and I realize we're speaking broadly here, but do those voters respond to a different kind of message, depending on your party affiliation or your independence?
Most of the experiments that have been done look at sort of average effects across the population, but they've been replicated so many times in different places that these seem to be pretty universal. I mean, one thing that's really interesting about this move towards having behavioral psychologists sort of develop the hypotheses about what can motivate voters is that they have an idea that politics, unlike a lot of political operatives, they don't think that some of these categories, party identification, age, race, are necessarily so salient when we get to the core questions of human behavior. And so they're looking for sort of universal levers that sort of play with things that are in the human brain, the need to fit in, the need to sort of live up to the expectations that we set for ourselves, our communities, and in ways that little bits of political communication, what volunteers say to you on the phone when they call you, what somebody says when they knock on your door, what the mail says, can sort of play with those expectations. And that is something that the psychologists who are driving a lot of this research don't believe is likely to differentiate a lot based on your party or ideology.
About a minute before we have to say goodbye, but I wonder, you know, how many people answer their door, answer the phone, or read the, you know, the stuff that is stuffed in their mailbox?
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about these randomized control trials is that they can account for who doesn't process the message, because the idea is that every group, every sample would have sort of the same noise across it, and the only difference is the language and the script that people are receiving. And so what makes a transformative tool in actually measuring this stuff in the real world is you can go out and you're looking at the impact of the message as it was delivered across a large group, and don't have, as is the case in a focus group, where you're sort of forcing people to read it, listen, and respond.
Well, Sasha Eisenberg, thanks for joining us once again today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he is a Victory Lab columnist for Slate, also Washington correspondent for The Monocle, covering politics, business, diplomacy, and culture. Wrote a book called The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, and was a guest on Radio Times earlier this year talking about that book. We have two guests waiting in the wings. We'll be talking more broadly about the race for the White House, the presidential campaign, this week's debate, and much, much more. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
AS1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, This Is the Week That Is, the election special. Written and performed by Philadelphia's own Jennifer Childs and the This Is the Week That Is ensemble, 1812's annual political satire features a script that changes with the headlines and up-to-the-minute reporting on all the news that's fit to skewer. Tickets available at 215-592-9560 or at 1812productions.org.
Supporting WHYY, the fully inclusive Waldorf Kindergarten offers full and half-day programs in a socially and emotionally rich environment where children learn through play in a holistic and nurturing setting. Learning is accomplished through puppet shows, seasonal celebrations, art, music, storytelling, and an abundance of outdoor activities and play. Hosting an open house at Camp Hill Special School's Chester County campus on October 6th. Details at camphillkindergarten.org.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Are you drinking more than you want to? Would you like to reduce your drinking? UPenn is conducting a 13-week research study of a medication to help people reduce their drinking. To participate, you must be 18 to 65 and a regular drinker. The study provides a medical evaluation, including blood tests, brief counseling, and monitoring of your drinking. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 241. 215-222-3200, extension 241.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. 2 days after the first presidential debate, there is general consensus that President Obama lost to Governor Romney because of his disengaged and passionless performance. But while Romney was aggressive and took control of the event, fact-checkers have been giving him some low marks on his tax plan, health care, and his promise to reduce deficit spending. Both candidates are out on the campaign trail working to drum up support, money, and enthusiasm. The new job numbers could influence the election. The unemployment rate dropped to 7.8% in September, with employers adding 114,000 new jobs. Meanwhile, Congress is on recess, having left behind unfinished business while the fiscal cliff looms on the horizon. We're here to talk about all of this is Susan Ferriccio and Todd Purdom. Susan Ferriccio is chief congressional correspondent covering both House and Senate for the Washington Examiner, was previously a reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Susan Ferriccio, nice to have you back with us on Radio Time.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Todd Purdom. He's Vanity Fair's national editor, a job he's had since 2006. Prior to that, he spent 23 years at the New York Times. And Todd Purdom, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Happy to be here.
And Todd, let me begin with you. And these jobs numbers, 7.8% unemployment rate for September, obviously below that 8%. How much do you think this helps President Obama?
Well, I think it's good news for the president because it changes the subject a bit. I mean, the polling data has tended to show that the public doesn't get very exercised about these jobs numbers month to month because they know that it's a long slog, and they've been very patient about it in some ways, and they don't change their opinions rapidly. But I think it'll make those of us in the media talk about the number and talk about how, for the first time in President Obama's administration, that number is now below 8%. And so that is something that can, you know, let him say, I told you we'd get it down, and we did. So I think for the next 48 hours, that will be helpful to him since he obviously had a bad night on Wednesday. It'll be interesting to see how much traction it gets in the long term because, of course, 114,000 jobs in a single month is not exactly a robust figure.
Indeed. Susan, let me give you a chance to respond to that. Then I do want to do some more quarterbacking on the Wednesday night debate. How do you think the Romney campaign will use these numbers?
Well, I think I agree with Todd in that it will give Obama something to talk about, and I think it will give him something longer to talk about for more than just a couple of days. That's the number people focus on. It's the jobless number. I mean, there's all kinds of economic indicators that the public kind of their eyes glaze over but are very important, like manufacturing jobs, for instance, which are down this month. They don't focus on that. It's that one number. You know, it's been above 8%, and Romney's been out on the campaign trail to answer your question talking about the fact that, you know, this jobless number has been above 8% for, you know, months and months and months here, and Obama has not been able to bring it down. Well, he can't use that talking point anymore because now the number is under 7.8%. I'm curious to see how Romney talks about this number. There are already folks out there questioning the math behind it and whether or not this was some kind of ploy by the Obama administration to get that number down. Maybe they just fudge the numbers here and there. Already you're seeing people talk about conflicting numbers here. How has this gone down when, you know, other economic indicators suggest that the number should have gone up? But I don't know if Romney's going to tread into that area or not. It's kind of risky business. But you have Jack Welch, former CEO of General Electric, very respected person when talking about the economy, already saying this doesn't make any sense. So let's see how Romney reacts in the days ahead on this new number. It's going to take away one of his main talking points, which is that the unemployment rate has remained above 8% all these months.
I see that he's already out with a statement saying this is not what a real recovery looks like. We created fewer jobs in September than in August and fewer jobs in August than in July, and we've lost over 600,000 manufacturing jobs since President Obama took office. So he's not going to see any good news in it. But it's interesting, Susan, because this business of questioning the veracity, you know, sort of arguing the truth of numbers, has become a real problem this season. As you know, in the previous weeks, there were a lot of conservative critics who were complaining that the polls were not accurately reflecting the situation on the ground and had somehow been skewed by the media to favor President Obama. So this is just another in an example of people not even being able to agree on the facts.
And polls have shown, too, that people are already saying, Do we trust the media anymore? And polls are showing people are less and less trusting what the media have to say, reporting on the election, you know, and you just get the sense that maybe the public, you know, is perhaps won't buy these numbers or will question the administration. But I don't know. I think people see that number, 7.8%, and they think, well, it's improving, and but let's think back. I know a lot of you may not remember the election of President George H.W. Bush against Bill Clinton. His employment numbers turned around just before the election in the same way that that's happening right now. It was a little bit too late, though, to help him, and I don't know if that same dynamic is at play here, but it's just something to keep in mind.
Well, and I think it just shows, Todd, just, I mean, everything is partisan these days,
yep.
Is it not? I mean,
yep.
Including a number.
No, I mean, you know, Senator Moynihan of New York used to say that everyone's entitled to his own opinions, but not to his own facts, and Governor Romney actually recycled that line as an attack on President Obama the other night. But the truth is we now have a country in which people seem to have a set of red facts and a set of blue facts, and they say they don't need the stinking facts of the other side. They'll take their own facts. And I think that's been one of the most depressing developments of the past, say, 5 or 6 years, maybe even longer, in our national life.
Let me give you a chance to respond to that, Susan. Then I do want to get to the debate. But do you see the hyper-partisanship that Todd Purdom just described?
I do, and I see it in my email inbox. I do a lot of campaign travel. I'm out talking to voters all the time, and I hear it from them. And they write me, and I sense that people are really divided. And you see that, if you want to see a fine example of how divided the nation is, just look at the U.S. Congress and with sort of ricochet effect that you see where we swing back from one kind of Congress to another, where we've got a very liberal Congress, now you get a Congress with the Tea Party factions. It's really, you're not seeing, where's the middle? It's not there in Congress. It's definitely affecting what kind of laws are being put in place, and it's definitely affecting the way our government is functioning. And you're just wondering, where is it coming from? And from talking to voters, you know, people really are divided, and it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
Indeed. As I said, let me go back to Wednesday night and go back to you, Todd, because I think there's still a lot of head-scratching among Democrats, supporters of Obama, I even think critics of Obama, head-scratching about his, as has been described, his lackluster performance on Wednesday night. Do you see a kind of method in what he did or didn't do?
No, I think there definitely was a method, and his first goal was to do no harm. He wanted to go in there. He felt he was sitting on a small but discernible lead, and he didn't want to do anything to mess it up. He also wanted to appear presidential, and that meant he didn't want to get in a scrappy fight with Mitt Romney. He didn't want to look like he was demeaning himself to get into a mud fight with his opponent. And I think there's also something at work, which has been said by many commentators, and that is when you're the president, people don't talk to you the way Mitt Romney talked to him the other night. Mm-hmm. And President Obama doesn't like to be talked to that way, and I think it bothered him, and perhaps his looking down and taking notes was a way. I remember famously 4 years ago, Senator McCain had been advised by his advisors not to really look at President Obama because they felt he couldn't contain the curl of his lip that, you know, of the contempt that he felt for him. And I think President Obama does feel some measure of contempt for Governor Romney, and perhaps he was trying to avoid giving any verbal or body language cues about that. The result was, though, that he looked like he wasn't really even paying attention.
Or that he looked bored and certainly disengaged. You called him Mr. Spock in a piece you wrote for Vanity Fair.
Well, you know, the president's great asset is that he is, in fact, cool as a cucumber. And his sister told me 6 years ago in Hawaii, before he ever, you know, really just as his campaign was getting started, that he's, a very cool customer. And that served him very well in his political career and in his whole life, really. And it's just the way he is. He's not an effort to be that way. That is the way he is. So I think he feels, I'm not going to change now. As you also note, in the days before the debate, there was this whole resurfacing of a 2007 speech that the then Senator Obama had made, in which he was talking to a largely African-American audience, and some in the right wing were trying to use that to portray him as a kind of, you know, angry black man. So I'm sure he was quite conscious also of thinking that the last thing he wanted to do in the debate was to play into any stereotype like that. So.
And Susan, it is interesting to hear the president the day after the debate, you know, on the trail, all that passion, calling out Mitt Romney, but as many of his critics have said, you know, a day late. How do you see the president's performance?
I agree with Todd in so many ways just about, you know, what may have been going on behind the scenes. I also think it's also part of Obama's personality. He is very cool and can appear detached when people are questioning him. I noticed that back when he was campaigning in 2008 and just the way his behavior was when he was off the campaign podium. Now, he does very well in front of big audiences, and again, you might say with a teleprompter. People were joking after, well, he didn't have a teleprompter, that's why he didn't do as well. I mean, that may be it in part. I think back to the 2008 campaign, and he was debating Hillary Clinton. He had a few moments there that hurt him, you know, when he remembered the comment in New Hampshire where he said, well, you're likable enough, Hillary, and then, of course, people suspected that may have hurt his chances in the primary that he eventually lost a few days later. But, again, he did, you know, when I saw that performance, the first thing I thought was, okay, he's kind of, you know, in sports terms, taking a knee here. He feels like it's the end of the game. I mean, I really felt strongly about this. And then talking to David Plouffe right after this ended, because I was at the debate, it kind of reinforced that. They feel like, hey, we're going to win this thing because we've got the swing states, and we've got them by enough of a margin right now that this is how we're going to win. Can Romney say after this debate that he is going to tie us in Ohio? Is he going to tie us in Florida and Nevada, or get ahead of us in Florida and in Nevada? If not, we're going to win this thing. Their goal here is let's not lose this. They feel like they're getting near the end. So why does he want to come in there and take big risks? He wants to look above it all. He wants to look presidential, but he doesn't want to get all scrappy because that would make things a little too, you know, that could change the game. And so what happened was he kind of really, again, like I said, he kind of like took a knee and didn't really get into the fight. And I don't think he expected what he got from Romney, and he very quickly was put on the defensive and could not recover.
Do you think there are risks that, Todd, of not taking risks and being on the knee, as Susan was saying?
Well, absolutely, and I suspect we'll see a totally different kind of performance in the second debate. For one thing, it'll be a town hall format, which is apt to favor Obama more. Romney has not been particularly great in those settings. I think the other thing that was a work is that Governor Romney came out there with basically a wholly new set of arguments and a line of attack, and President Obama was presumably prepared to respond to all the things that Romney has been saying for months, and instead we saw this kind of Mitt Romney 2.0, who came out there and started talking about a tax and economic plan that he was really, in a sense, unveiling for the first time that night. And I think the president was probably genuinely flummoxed about how to respond to it without saying, this is just a bunch of hooey and you must be kidding me. And I think he didn't want to, you know, do that to look too combative. But I think he was prepared for an altogether different sort of Mitt Romney than the one who came out on the stage, and I think that probably messed with his head.
Well, we are talking about Wednesday night's presidential debate and politics in general, the race for the White House, talking with Todd Purdom. He is a national editor at Vanity Fair, also with us Susan Ferriccio, a chief congressional correspondent for the Washington Examiner, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Why? Susan, do you think there were risks for Romney, picking up on what Todd was just saying about he was for certain degrees of regulation? He said he wouldn't cut education. He seemed to embrace parts of Obamacare, or certainly to acknowledge what he had done when he was governor of Massachusetts. Is he in danger of angering the more conservative parts of his party by taking these more moderate positions?
No, and the reason I say that is, again, when I speak to the very conservative voters out there, there are so many of them who will say to me, you know, I really liked Rick Santorum, or I fear Romney may not be conservative enough for me. But then they all say, but I'm going to go vote for him.
Is that because they don't like Obama?
Exactly, and because they want a Republican in the White House. I don't think it's going to hurt him with his base. Let's get down to the chase here of what both candidates are looking for right now. Obama's not worried about his base. Neither is Romney. They're worried about this percentage of folks who are either undecided completely, and there aren't very many of them, or what we call the soft voters, who they like Obama or maybe they like Romney, but maybe they could change their mind with a certain kind of debate performance. Who knows? With some kind of, you know, change in the jobless number, with some kind of big development of some kind. Who knows? Libya, what happened in Libya? Foreign affairs could come into play. Anything could change the game for these few voters. And because the election is, you know, predicted to be so close, and we've seen many close presidential elections and congressional elections, it's possible these few percentage of voters are really going to matter. So both Romney and Obama are going after this group. So for Romney to get up there and talk about health care reform in that manner, I think is fine for him. I don't think that the risk for him is losing his base at this point.
What do you think, Todd?
No, I totally agree with Susan. And the Republican Party, broadly defined, is suddenly so excited. I mean, there were big segments of the party that were terribly worried about Governor Romney and maybe not ready to write him off, but one step away from it. And this just put a whole shot of adrenaline into the race again and made them feel, gee, you know, this is a contest. It's risky for the Obama camp, though, because what they now started to do yesterday is to portray Governor Romney as a flip-flopper. And last spring, they had a whole bunch of discussions with Bill Clinton, who urged them, you know, don't paint him as a flip-flopper. That doesn't really work, because people who are worried about whether he's too conservative will then think, oh, well, he's not really that conservative. He'll get in there and be pretty reasonable. Paint him as an extremist, and that will work. Well, the Governor Romney who came out on the stage Wednesday night did not come off like an extremist. So he can't be both things. He can't be a rigid extremist and he, at the same time, be a flip-flopper. So they've now, the Obama people have kind of doubled down on this strategy of calling him a flip-flopper, and that's going to, we'll see how that plays in the next month.
Susan, I thought it was interesting that Governor Romney has admitted that his 47% comment was a mistake, something that didn't come up on Wednesday night, but by, and essentially saying, you know, I probably shouldn't have said that. Does he take away some ammunition from the Obama administration or from the president himself?
For him, are you saying because Obama didn't bother bringing it up on...
And Mitt Romney, I think he was being interviewed by one of the Fox people, basically said, yeah, I shouldn't have said that. That was a mistake on my part.
It most certainly does. In fact, my view of this is there was a chance for it to come up during the debate, and it didn't. And I think that it had even the Obama folks scratching their heads, because I know immediately after the debate, they were talking about it and saying, well, we just felt like we didn't need to bring it up. And their reasoning varied from one surrogate to another. And I know I heard several different reasons, which tells me that I don't think they really knew why he didn't bring it up. But the final answer I got from David Plouffe was, well, we feel like people already know about the 47% comment, so we didn't need to bring it up, which I think, frankly, is a ridiculous explanation.
Is that ridiculous, Todd?
Yeah.
We're about a minute from our break here, but there was something you wrote in one of your Vanity Fair articles, quoting a Pew Research Center, saying the conservative Republicans who think Obama is a Muslim has doubled in the last 4 years. What does that tell you, Todd?
Well, it tells you that there are a lot of people who so dislike President Obama that they have to find a justification for their dislike, whether it's true or not. And it also tells you that there has been a relentless campaign in entirely disreputable quarters and, more perniciously, among some respectable people who say things like, I take him at his word that he's a Christian, or I have no reason to doubt that he's a Christian. And so, you know, in a population that's already deeply suspicious of him for a host of reasons, that takes root and allows people to feel that they have a justification for being nervous about him. And I do think that it's another example of... the birth certificate being another one. I think he's been conclusively proven to have been born in Hawaii, and for any other thing to have happened would have involved such a massive conspiracy over 50 years that it's impossible, you know.
Well, that's Todd Purdom. He's a national editor at Vanity Fair. Also with us, Susan Ferriccio, chief congressional correspondent for the Washington Examiner. And we are taking stock of the week's worth of political news, focusing largely on the presidential debate and election. Stay with us. Call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY. Independence Blue Cross is dedicated to transforming healthcare to make a better coordinated system that is built around you. They're committed to leading the way to focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it, pioneering new ways to pay healthcare professionals based on the quality of care, and using technology to update your medical information electronically so everyone can be informed. Further details online at ibx.com. Independence Blue Cross, changing the game.
Penn professor and geoscientist Jane Willenbring will discuss whether human activities or nature are more responsible for the apparent acceleration in erosion around the world on Wednesday, October 10th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on the Penn campus. The lecture is open to the public and is sponsored by Penn's Master of Environmental Studies program, a proud supporter of WHYY. Details can be found online by searching Penn MES.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association announces the 6th Annual Cape May Wine Festival, October 6th and 7th from noon until 5 p.m. Held at the Cape May Lewis Ferry Terminal, the event will take place outdoors on the Delaware Bay waterfront. Attendees can sample wines from 24 New Jersey wineries. Other festival features include food, crafts, live music, and a kids' zone. More information at newjerseywines.com. The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Todd Purdom and Susan Ferriccio, spending a fair amount of time talking about Wednesday night's debate when President Obama, Governor Romney had their first of three debates, Romney taking control of a wonky 90 minutes. Both candidates have taken their campaigns back on the trail in swing states. We're talking about this, and I do want to spend a little time talking about Congress as well, but let's get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We have Day calling us from Gilbertsville. And Day, go ahead. You're on the air.
Sure. I'm wondering about how it is that seems like for the last 25 years, the Democrats have failed to respond to what I see the right as taking ownership of who and who is not an American. I mean, they paint the picture of American of an American as an entrepreneur, as a loner, as a free spirit, and that the picture of being American as freedom is money. And there's no response to that from Democrats. That's a mistake to allow ownership of that kind of message.
Well, Dave,
and that, yes.
No, let me take your point and see what our guests have to say. Todd Purdom, do you see it that way?
Well, I think that's a real issue, and I have to say that I think the most effective Democratic spokesman to counter that argument has been, and we just saw it again last month, Bill Clinton. There's no one who's effective as he is about saying, hey, I'm just as American as you are, and all the people who are friendly with me are too. And President Obama made a big stab at doing that in 2004 with his breakout keynote speech in Boston at the convention when he said, of course, you know, we have some, we worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we have some great gay friends in the red states, and we're not red or blue America, we're the United States of America. And for whatever reason, he's partly because of the implacable Republican opposition, he's been unable, and partly because of his cool personality and his kind of cerebral manner, he has not been able to really change that tone or do much about that while in office. But, you know, we see now on the campaign trail a Bill Clinton doing a version of that almost every day, and he's clearly been an enormous asset, not just to President Obama, but to the whole Democratic Party.
Yes, interesting. Do you want to comment on Bill Clinton, Susan?
Well,
the role that he's playing?
Yeah, Bill Clinton, he was just absolutely of complete and total value for the Obama campaign during the convention and the speech he delivered, where he essentially gave the most important line, I think, of the whole convention, which is to say, hey, not even I could have fixed the economy. In other words, it's okay to, you know, it's really not President Obama's fault that we are where we are right now. And of course, you know, Clinton appealed to a different part of the electorate, I think, because he was more of a moderate. So that has to be, and he's from, you know, Arkansas. It's just a whole, he's a different kind of candidate entirely.
Day, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me get Kate from Norristown to join us. Kate, go ahead. You're on the air.
When are Democrats going to learn what Republicans have been doing and are still doing and what Romney was doing during the debate, which is choosing a handful of points and making them forcefully over and over and over again? Everybody in the Republican Party seems to come out with the same arguments at the same time, and they flood the area with them. President Obama's way of dealing with problems is much, much better for a president than somebody who's good at the game that the Republicans play. But people are convinced by that forceful, pushing kind of way of expressing themselves. They take it as strength. It's actually a pretty dangerous thing for a president, I think. But
well,
yes.
No, let me take your, thank you for calling in, Kate. Let me take your call. And Susan, let me give you a chance to weigh in on that.
That's interesting. You know, after Obama finished, I heard, you know, you heard a whole range of critiques of his performance. Some saying, well, geez, he sure looked listless up there, to others saying, well, he was steady and thoughtful, and, you know, even though he wasn't, you know, jumping off the podium and looking terribly excited, he was presidential. You know, there's always that argument that, you know, doesn't a charismatic and enthusiastic candidate translate into a great president? And so there's, I think that's what the caller is trying to say. I think both, you know, in terms of trying to get up there and hammer home a point, I think both candidates try to do that. Obviously, the president, as the incumbent, I think we should say this straight off the bat, we didn't say this at the beginning of the interview, is always at a disadvantage in these debates because he is the president. So he walks in having to kind of play defense just from the get-go. And so that gives Romney an advantage. Everybody pretty much universally agrees that it's very much easier for someone to come in and beat the incumbent president because mm-hmm. they've got the president's 3 years, his record, to attack. So that's part of what I think the callers witnessed from watching the debate. Now, the question of who was more charismatic, I think very clearly it was Romney, and charisma wins elections. They have historically, and they always will, I think.
Well, and Todd, just picking up on that and looking at actually something from NPR, but a lot of fact-checking organizations have looked at what both President Obama and Governor Romney said on Wednesday night. And I have to say, looking at the critiques in totality, it looks as if Romney got lower grades on when it came to fact-checking.
Well, I think that's pretty clear, yeah. And I think one of the dangers of oversimplification of bullet points is that you can, you know, stretch the facts a little bit because you don't have room for the subtleties. But to answer the caller's point, I do think the Democrats try just as hard as the Republicans to have these talking points, and sometimes they succeed. I mean, certainly 4 years ago, the Obama campaign was fiercely disciplined with its talking points and its arguments against John McCain. 20 years ago, the Clinton campaign, you know, in some ways retired the title for the Democrats in the modern era by having that famous, everyone remembers, it's the economy, stupid.
Right.
But the other thing that President Clinton, Governor Clinton said over and over and over again that people forgot is change versus more of the same. And on James Carville's board in the war room, that slogan was actually ahead of it's the economy, stupid. And the third thing was don't forget health care. So we're still in some ways, we're still in the same three set of arguments, you know.
Interesting. Susan, let me ask you a little bit about Congress. I'm not sure how their approval rating, what the approval rating is today, but we know it's pretty darn low. There also looks like there's a fair amount of unfinished business. They came back after Labor Day. Now they're in recess again, and they've got a lot of stuff facing them when they get back after the election. What's on the docket when they get back?
A lot. In fact, historically speaking, maybe too much. They're not going to have a lot of time. They come back the week after the election, and then they'll work for a week or so. Then they've got a week off for Thanksgiving. And then they've basically got December to get finished, to agree on things that they haven't been able to agree on for the past year. And those include some very important and consequential pieces of legislation. There are, first and foremost, the tax cuts that almost everybody is enjoying now in their paychecks. It's about to expire, and when they do expire in January, everybody's going to start paying a lot more in taxes suddenly, and it's, you know, potentially very dangerous for the economy for that to happen all at once. Secondly, the nation is facing this word I think that people have heard tossed around called sequestration, which
yes.
is just another word for automatic cuts that are about to come down universally across the budget. And, of course, the entire budget includes our military. So it's more than $1 trillion in cuts that could be devastating, not only to domestic spending and critical programs, but to our nation's military and our ability to protect our security and keep our troops safe overseas. So they've got to figure out a way to reduce spending by that amount of money, but change it so we're not, you know, cutting in critical military spending or critical domestic spending. And they've not been able to agree upon that at all for the past year. And now suddenly they're expected to do it in just these few weeks after the election. The theory behind that being, well, once the politicking is over and once the election is over, we'll all be more willing to compromise. Now, the last few weeks they've been able to get things done like that, but on a much smaller scale and with great difficulty. So now we have a much bigger, more critical agenda with very little time. and that leaves some people wondering, are they really going to get it done in time?
Well, Todd, this is a more philosophical question, and then we'll get back to our callers. But do we have a political system that can fix our pressing problems?
Well, one has to really worry about that. I mean, for some time, the approval rating of Congress has been so low that John McCain likes to joke it reflects the support of only paid staff and blood relatives. But, you know, over and over again, we have seen in recent years the Congress unable to act until it has a gun to its head, and even then not always able to act very effectively. Susan's totally right that this problem has been obvious for months. The notion that it should be solved in the 6 weeks after the election is really preposterous. On the other hand, both parties feel there's no incentive to try to do anything about it or put themselves out on the line because there'll be a great decision on November 6th, and presumably that will have implications for the future. What makes me worried is that whoever wins the presidency, I could see the losing side digging in and being more determined than ever to fight some kind of rearguard action, especially, I think, if President Obama should win re-election. I'm not at all sure that the congressional Republicans will really be in a mood to compromise. I think they'll be furious, and they'll feel that, you know, they had a potential defeat snatched from the jaws of a potential victory turned into defeat, you know, because of the flaws in the Romney campaign. And I think they'll just be, they may well hunker down and torture the Democrats.
Well, and if the president loses, do you think the Democrats then would get some kind of revenge on Romney for what has been done when Obama was president?
Oh, I think it's just as possible that they would try to do that. Yeah, of course. And I just don't think the way the dynamics of the Congress are set up and the way the districts are drawn and the way that the there is no structural incentive for cross-party cooperation. And that's a big change from the situation that prevailed for, you know, much of the 20th century. And we're still living with the consequences of that.
Let me get Arlene from Downingtown to join us on Radio Times. Arlene, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I would like to make a comment with regard to your commentator's remark about Obama being cool as a cucumber and not being quite as prepared for what he expected Romney to say. I go back to Hillary's question, and I ask, who do you want picking up that phone at 3 a.m. It begins with leadership. He needs to be prepared. He needs to have a backbone. And you just look at the way he handled Libya and how long it took for them to come out to say, yes, it was a terrorist. And that's the same with Congress. We need a leader. Yes, that place is broken down in Washington, D.C., and we need somebody with a backbone instead of being complacent and just trying to please one side or the other. I think it starts at the top. And that's my comment.
Well,
I believe he's... Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, who's the one with the backbone from your perspective?
I guess at this point, I mean, I'm the person that doesn't really care for either. I'm going to vote for the worst of two evils.
Uh-huh.
And I look at last tonight's debate.
Yes.
And I really didn't like the way Obama handled it. And I see him doing that many times. He has a teleprompter. He has somebody else writing. And he's very strong. But when he has to shoot from the hip, I see him with stuttering and not prepared.
Okay.
I just think he needs to be more of a leader. I right now I'd go for Romney.
Okay, fair enough, Arlene. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. And Susan, you have been following, I'm not sure if it's both candidates on the trail, but certainly Mitt Romney on the trail. Does this sound like one of his supporters?
Yes, I think so. She does sound like she's supporting Romney. I mean,
not happily. Yeah, not happily, but nonetheless. She doesn't like Obama.
There are people are following this stuff pretty closely, and I think the situation in Libya was alarming to a lot of folks. It polled that people were really focused on that, even though foreign policy is something people's eyes glaze over about. But an earlier part of her comment was interesting, just about, you know, in Congress, where's the leadership in Congress and where's the leadership in the White House? I think, you know, as Todd was saying, you know, things have really changed in the past several election cycles. And I feel as though in my observation of Congress and the White House and how they all interact is that leadership really in many ways has been replaced by this partisanship and this need to get reelected that kind of dominates everything in government right now, not even just the White House, but certainly in Congress. And it's that combined with what I think is just a humongous philosophical divide between Republicans, Democrats, and Congress, that is really the main reason why nothing gets done. And then the public walks away pretty angry about how their government is functioning, and rightfully so. You know, Congress lingers in the low double digits in poll numbers, and they can never get much higher than that. And part of the reason is they all they do is fight, and all they do is take the nation to the brink again and again and again, either with the federal government threatening to close down because they can't approve or just a regular old budget, or the situation we're facing right now where we could end up seeing, you know, thousands of dollars in tax increases for every paycheck and the economy going into a tailspin because both sides are not willing to compromise because they're so the partisanship and everyone every man for himself has really become the order of the day in government. And you know, I witness that every day in both Congress and the White House.
Well, let me just jump in here. And final question to you, Todd Purdom. And Mitt Romney touts his experience as a businessman. Do business skills translate to politics?
Well, historically, they haven't shown to translate very effectively to the presidency. In fact, you could argue that the most successful businessmen who ever become president, Warren Harding, Herbert Hoover, Jimmy Carter, none of them had what we would consider a classically successful presidency. And the truth is, the skills of a business person are often not the skills of a political leader. And when Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts, he did not really, yes, he was able to get some things done, health care and so forth, but he had a reputation for trying to avoid the political process. He didn't really like working with the Democrats in the state house. He didn't really like mixing it up in politics. And a political leader does have to persuade other people. It's a different task than pleasing investors or pleasing your board of directors. You have to persuade the people who don't like you. And when Governor Romney's father was governor of Michigan, he said it was like being a quarterback of a team in which the opposing team had the ball all the time. And so it's interesting.
It is interesting, and that is politics. And that's Todd Purdom. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Pleasure to be here.
And he's national editor at Vanity Fair. And Susan Friccio, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You're welcome. She's chief congressional correspondent covering both the House and the Senate for the Washington Examiner. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also check us out. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.